genocide, about that horrific 3 months in 1994 when millions of people of the Hutu tribe rose up to attack millions of people of the Tutsi tribe, basically hacking their neighbors to bits, and some 800,000 people died in that very short period of time. The movie, I suspect, will be a successful movie. As I said, it has all the elements of suspense and sadness and anger and horror. I myself don't really go to a lot of nonfiction horror movies. I don't really see the point. And as the movie ended and I saw everyone sitting in shock afterwards, and some people were crying and many were just staring blankly at the screen, I wondered whether people really saw the difference. I hope they do. I assume they do. But sometimes I fear that people thought, wow, what a powerful film. And then they would say the same about Aliens 3 or any other kind of nonfiction horror film. My reaction was not one so much of sadness and shock, though that was there, as one of anger. Anger that we did so little then. Anger that we're doing so little now. Indeed, I was angry at myself for not doing enough shows on the current genocide, the genocide that's lasted not 3 months but 2 years, the current genocide in Sudan. I did a story early on the genocide in Sudan. In fact, you can still find it on my website at www.radioinsidescoop.com. It was more than a year ago when we first heard reports. And I purposely had a guest that was... I had two guests, in fact. One was a Christian missionary, and one was a worker for Amnesty International. And I wanted to show that people on the far right and the far left, and everyone in between, whatever your moral value, should be concerned about genocide, should do something about it. And what we see is that the current government, like the government in 1994, is doing little to nothing. Maybe a few words here or there, but sending troops? No way. Apparently, the movie is correct. The blacks of Africa just aren't important enough a United States interest. So I want to talk about the film. There's a lot to talk about this hour, and I realize I'm probably trying to talk about too much, but I want to talk about the film, what happened in Rwanda. I want to spend most of the hour talking about Sudan, and in fact, coming on in the break will be my guest, Professor Eric Reeves of Smith College, who can give us the very latest about what's going on in Sudan, and hopefully give us some indication as to what we can do to get our government, to get our president, who talks so often about freedom and liberty and democracy, to care just a bit about the genocide going on in Sudan. And then later on in the hour, I do want to talk about the controversy about recent documents coming out about the Holocaust, showing the Catholic Church's role in that, and the Nazi collaborator, Pope Pius XII. It seems to me that it's not just a question of what we do during a genocidal episode, though obviously that's the most important. Sudan is the most important. But what we do afterwards, I would argue that our failure to recognize what happened in the Holocaust, our apology, Clinton's apology for what happened in Rwanda, that all these things are very important to preventing future genocides in the future. I would also argue that the word genocide is overused. Used too much to show, oh, well, this bad person is committing genocide. And as I myself believe that genocide is one of the few and only examples where the United States, I believe, should go to war even where it has not been attacked, I think it's important to define what genocide is and tell you how I think the world has been overused. There are all kinds of evil acts in the world that did not rise to the level of what I believe is the greatest possible human crime. So let's look at a definition of genocide here. Genocide, of course, was coined after the Holocaust, perhaps the greatest example of genocide. It is the deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, religious, or cultural group of human beings. Again, the deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, religious, or cultural group of human beings. You can find several definitions, but I think that's one of the best. And the point is, it's what genocide is where you basically take men, women, and children Rip them out of their daily lives, people who aren't attacking you, people who aren't in wartime necessarily, but certainly people who aren't, you know, raising arms against you, but taking these people, removing them from their homes, and systematically chopping them to bits or gassing them. It is, I think, the greatest of human crimes. And in fact, if I have two criticisms for Hotel Rwanda, I'll give them right now. The first is not relating the film to the current day. Maybe everyone knew that's what it was about, just as people who watched MASH about the Korean War seemed to know it was about Vietnam. But sometimes people need to be hit over the head a little, and when the film ends, it ends with words flashed on the screen in silence, telling us that the story is true, telling us what happened to the hero of the story, who managed to save a few lives in the middle of this awful destruction. But I would argue the film needed a little bit more. It needed, at the end of the film, two more flashes of information. One, for 2 years now, genocide has been going on in the Darfur region of the Sudan. Two, the governments of the United States and other countries around the world and the United Nations have done little or nothing to stop it. That's all. Just those two words. And I have to admit, I was angry at the film afterwards, and it was such a powerful film, and I really hate to criticize it, but I was angry at the film. I was angry at a lot after seeing that film for not putting up those two little news flashes that genocide is ongoing in Sudan today, and the world is doing so little to stop it. And there's a lot of blame to go around. Sure, I blame the Bush administration, but I also blame the United Nations, and I also blame European nations. You know, genocide is not, unfortunately, that unusual. You know, after the Holocaust, people said, never again, never again. We'll never allow this to happen again. And maybe not the scale of the Holocaust has happened, but it has happened again. Indeed, it happened before the Holocaust. The genocide of Armenia at the turn of the century should have given us an indication of what could happen in modern days. After all, genocides had gone on for thousands of years in the past. Different groups of mankind have sought to exterminate other groups of mankind. Largely, it was directed against Jews because the Christian church had taught for centuries anti-Semitism, had accused Jews of killing Jesus and therefore helping to fuel the fire for the many, many Christian massacres against Jews. But it's not just that, of course. It's the Crusades, it's the Inquisitions, it's Christians killing Muslims and Muslims killing Christians, and a whole lot of killing going on for religious wars, racial wars, and so forth. But after the Holocaust, we said never again. And of course, Cambodia happened, the killing fields. We did nothing there. And then Rwanda, 1994. And true, it only happened in 3 months. Bill Clinton had very little time to act, but there's no question it was a great moral failing of his to act, to not act. Actually, before Rwanda, we had the genocide that went on in Bosnia under George Bush Sr., where not only did the president fail to act, but actually the United Nations declared safe zones in Srebrenica. In other words, if you leave your homes, if you give up your wealth, you give it all to your enemies, at least you can save your lives if you go to safe zones, places like Srebrenica. And the United States and George Bush Sr. have promised people would be safe there too. And when they came to kill them, the United Nations and George Bush Sr. were silent, allowed the killings to occur. To my knowledge, George Bush Sr. never apologized for that. Bill Clinton has made two apologies of sorts. One, when genocide came again in Kosovo, he recognized the mistake he made in Rwanda, and he did build up an international group to stop the killing in a terrific war where actually not a single American life was lost, solely to save people's lives. And then, of course, Clinton apologized for what he did in Rwanda. And I know there's lots of people that attack Bill Clinton for that apology. They think that you should never apologize for something you've done wrong because that just, illustrates the wrong you've done. A lot of people say that's why George Bush Jr. should never admit mistakes. But I praise Clinton for that apology, as much as I condemn him for failing to act in 1994. Would you prefer that Clinton had not apologized? And Clinton put his policy where his mouth was, and he went in and he stopped the killing in Kosovo. I'm very, very proud of Bill Clinton for that. George Bush Jr., what's he doing in Sudan? A genocide that has lasted now 8 times as long as the one in Rwanda, which happened in 3 months? Nothing. Nothing. The president talks about freedom and liberty and democracy, is doing nothing. Maybe a little bit of lip service. Again, kind of like the Catholic Pope during World War II. A little bit of lip service. But in essence, he's doing nothing. And so I wanted to do a show today to encourage you to do something, to do what I've done, to call your member of Congress and urge them to send American troops to Sudan. You know, it's okay. When you're negotiating with a contained dictator like Saddam Hussein or like the Soviet Union, those things can last. You can take your time. You can try sanctions. You can try all kinds of things. But when it comes to genocide, you have to act now. And if it means pulling troops out of Iraq, so be it. So be it. We've got to do something about Sudan. My guest is coming on in just a minute. Before he does, I want to talk about the definition of genocide and the misuse of the word. I've heard genocide used in all kinds of contexts. Amazingly, on the blog at RadioInsideScoop.com, I hear people talking about Saddam Hussein committing genocide and then not condemning American leaders that helped Saddam Hussein do what he did, which is help gas the Kurds in the 80s. And, of course, those leaders were Ronald Reagan and George Bush Sr. and Donald Rumsfeld and Dick Cheney, whose company Halliburton continued to deal with Saddam Hussein in the 90s. I don't know that Saddam Hussein's crimes against the Kurds rise to the level of genocide. I do know this, that I myself was contacting my member of Congress, urging him to support the Kurds and support the Shiites when they had an uprising against Saddam Hussein back in 1992. And I also actively called on our government to stop aiding Saddam Hussein. At the time, we were helping him gas those Kurdish people. Again, I don't know if it's genocide. I don't know that Saddam Hussein was actually trying to exterminate the Kurdish people. That doesn't mean it was good. There's lots of evil in the world that's not genocide. And I think that sometimes that people want to call everything Hitler, everything Nazi, everything genocide, and they do it on purpose as a way to say, oh, my point is a major point. And it happens on the right and it happens on the left. On the left are people that are disgusted by Bush's policies, as I am, but then they say Bush is committing genocide. Not true. Bush is a lousy, horrible president. He's not committing genocide. That's not fair on the left. There are people on the right that compare abortion to genocide. Now, I realize that people who are strongly pro-life believe abortion is an evil act. I strongly support their right to have that opinion. But I think even they wouldn't call it equivalent to genocide. Why does everything have to be equivalent to genocide? It's call it evil, call it horrific. That's fine. We can have a debate on that. But I don't think even they believe that abortion, killing a, even though they believe that an embryo, that a, I just don't think they believe it's equivalent to killing a child, to taking a 7-year-old from their parents and gassing him in the gas chambers. I just don't think it's the same. I don't think they think it's the same. Again, you can call things evil without calling them genocide. On the left, we see people attacking the state of Israel, calling its actions genocide. Look, you can complain about Israel's treatment of Palestinians without calling it genocide. We hear this term used too much. And I would argue, and I'm going to ask one of the first questions I'm going to ask my guest, is the overuse of the term genocide actually helping those who commit genocide? I think it is. I think the overuse of the term helps make, oh, well, if everything's genocide, then what I'm doing isn't so bad. And that's why it's essential to call genocide when we see it, whether it occurred in the past, whether it's the Catholic Church's role in the Holocaust, or the Bush administration's role right now in not doing hardly anything to stop the genocide in Sudan. We've got to call it as it is. If you want to call in and comment on any of this or talk to Professor Reeves or myself, you're always welcome to do so. The toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. We'll be right back with Professor Eric Reeves of Smith College, who's going to give us the grim update on what's going on in Darfur, Sudan. And I know you don't want to hear it. I know that. Frankly, I have to admit, as much as I hate to say it, when my friends said they wanted to see Hotel Rwanda, I said to myself, I don't want to see this. I should see it, but I didn't want to see it. And now I'm angry at my own reaction. It's more than I should have seen it. I'm glad I saw it. It's given me a renewed energy to do whatever we can to stop genocide wherever it occurs and to not let anyone who committed genocide in the past get away with it. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop and Professor Eric Reeves right after these messages.
Thinking about consolidating your federal student loans, it's time to call College Loan Corporation at 1-800-2-COLLEGE. You'll quickly be connected to an expert loan consultant who will explain the benefits of the consolidation program, including locking in the lowest rate in history, reducing your current monthly payment by up to 58%, and cutting down multiple payments into one simple check. For more information, call 1-800-2-COLLEGE. That's 1-800-2-COLLEGE. It's the smartest call you can make.
This is a financial update. Average mortgage rates took a slight dip this week.
Sorry to interrupt, but LendingTree.com is the only place where banks compete over your mortgage. Then you get up to four real offers to choose from within minutes. So do better and choose from low rates. Call LendingTree now at 1-800-555-TREE. That's 1-800-555-TREE. When banks compete, you win.
I know everything. Languages? Yes. Boiling points? Celsius and Fahrenheit? Yes. World capitals? Please. So, not too long ago, I tried to get a refi, and it got turned down. And this is the best part. The loan officer says to me, sir, do you know what your credit score is? So, I looked at her and said, tell me, do you know what the population of Liechtenstein is? Huh? Do you? She didn't.
Get in the know. Check out ScorePower from Equifax. You'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for only $14.95. And knowing that is how you get the credit you deserve. So check out ScorePower at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Well, now I have my credit score up to 760, the same number of days it took Frenchman Michel Lapointe to circle the globe on a bike. Yeah, I'll bet you didn't know that.
Get the power. Score power.
A message from the American Library Association and Bernie Mac about the hard times facing our nation's libraries.
Hey, I'm Bernie Mac, and libraries need your help. Many are forced to cut back hours, reduce services, and even close their doors. So what can you do? I tell you what, support your local library and help keep your library doors open. Contact your local library to find out how you can make a difference in your community. The future is at your library, so make sure your library has a future. Just a little something from the Mac Man.
Brought to you by the Campaign for America's Libraries. For more information, visit the American Library Association website at www.ala.org.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about what I believe is the worst human crime possible, the crime of genocide, the deliberate and systematic extermination of a national, racial, religious, or cultural group of human beings. What brings it up is, of course, the movie Hotel Rwanda, and yet it's something that we should be talking about a lot more often than that, especially since there seems to be an ongoing genocide occurring right now in Sudan. So I was propelled by the movie to have another show on genocide and specifically on Sudan. We need to talk about it as much as possible, find out what's going on, and find out what we can do to make a difference to stop this most horrific of human crimes. My guest now is Professor Eric Reeves of Smith College. Professor Reeves has been analyzing and studying the situation in Sudan for at least 6 years now, and I invite him on the show for lots of reasons, but one is to give us a current update as to what is going on in the Darfur region. Professor Reeves, welcome to the Inside Scoop.
Pleased to be with you.
Tell me, what is going on now in Darfur?
What we are seeing is an acceleration of what I call genocide by attrition. The third article of the Genocide Convention stipulates, or the third term of the actual acts that constitute genocide, speaks of creating conditions that make it impossible for people to live, the deliberate destruction of the means of livelihood. This is what we're seeing now, the full effects of the Khartoum regime's use of its own military forces and its brutal Arab Janjaweed militia allies to destroy the agricultural economy of the non-Arab or African populations of Darfur. The effects of 2 years of conflict, we've just entered the third year of this genocidal war, are such that I believe my research recently cited in the Washington Post, the New York Times, as well as the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation and a number of others, I believe over 400,000 people have already died, suggesting that we are halfway to Rwanda, to pick up on your point earlier. I also suggest in my research on mortality that approximately 1,000 people are dying every day and will do so for the foreseeable future. The violence continues largely unabated, threatening humanitarian operations throughout Darfur. Humanitarian capacity is woefully inadequate to human needs. We are looking at an engine of genocide by attrition that is racing and gives no sign of slowing down.
Now, as they say, the devil, in this case it's certainly devilish, is in the details. The reports I've seen, I'd like you to confirm, include planes dropping bombs, strafing the ground, machine gunning entire villages, and indeed burning entire villages to the ground, poisoning wells. Are all these things backed up?
All of these have been confirmed by numerous human rights reports from Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch, the International Crisis Group, UN investigations, journalists on the ground, and many humanitarian actors, most of whom necessarily remain anonymous. But we have just an overwhelming packet of evidence when you put all these reports together and all these accounts. And the destruction is actually even more systematic than you suggest. When a village is comprehensively destroyed, it's not just that the buildings are burned down, that the people are killed, women are raped, children are abducted, but fruit trees are cut down, wells are poisoned with corpses, irrigation systems are destroyed, agricultural implements are burned, seed stocks as well as food stocks are destroyed, ensuring that agricultural production cannot resume. Donkeys, which are an essential part of sedentary agriculture in Darfur, have been lost by the tens of thousands. There's been looting of cattle, which represent food, insurance, and generational wealth accumulated over many, many generations. This has all been destroyed, looted, and has left the displaced African populations of Darfur utterly bereft in very, very large and squalid displacement camps, where humanitarian conditions are appalling. These will become the factories of disease. They will breed also new recruits for the insurgency movements that are unfortunately beginning to disintegrate under the force of genocidal pressure.
And yet, Professor Reeves, the United Nations, much as it did 10 years ago, is not yet calling this a genocide, are they?
They are not. It depends who we mean by they. There are certainly some in the United Nations who know full well that this is genocide, and some have spoken out much more forthrightly than others. Mukesh Kapila, the UN humanitarian coordinator for all of Sudan, said in March of last year, the only difference between Rwanda and Darfur is the numbers involved. Well, 400,000 may not be 800,000, but unlike Rwanda, Darfur's genocide shows no sign of slowing down, far more than 100 days into this conflict. And indeed, as I suggested, a conflict which really began in February of 2003 is now in its third year with no end in sight. I strongly believe that we may see, by the time this engine of genocidal attrition is has run its course, we will see total mortality in excess of what we saw in Rwanda 10 years ago.
Now, Professor Reeves, there is, of course, a convention that the United States and a number of nations signed. At the United Nations, an article to prevent and punish the crime of genocide. And I wonder if, first of all, if under that convention, when genocide occurs, whether countries are obligated to act. And number two, if that's so, if that's the reason why you believe that some diplomats at the UN and in the Bush administration are dithering over definitions.
Well, actually, the Bush administration is fully committed to a genocide determination. There's been no backing away from Colin Powell's Senate testimony of September 9th, where he emphatically, without qualification, declared that Khartoum and its Janjaweed allies were, in fact, responsible for genocide in Darfur.
But aren't we then obligated to do something under these conventions?
We are. Unfortunately, as part of that Senate testimony, Colin Powell also said, nothing new follows from this genocide determination. In other words, the U.S., which had already crafted a U.N. Security Council resolution, which would be seriously weakened because of the threat of a Chinese veto, the U.S. referral of its already drafted Security Council resolution constituted the only response to genocide, even though we are a contracting party, as you say, to the 1948 Convention on the Prevention and Punishment of the Crime of Genocide. As a contracting party, we are obligated to prevent genocide, and yet we have not done so. To be sure, the September UN resolution called for a commission of inquiry. Here we are, many months later. The commission of inquiry has issued its very poorly reasoned report. Factually, it leaves much to be desired in its failure to conduct necessary forensic investigations. But its reasoning on the issue of genocide is just egregiously poor, self-contradictory in the most obvious ways. And I've discussed this with a number of other genocide scholars who are as appalled as I am by the legal reasoning here. So, unfortunately, we have a UN report which declares it doesn't find genocidal intent, even though it finds evidence of genocide. And we're paralyzed in some ways by this abysmal UN failure.
But I don't see why this paralyzes us. I mean, the United States certainly acted on its own in Kosovo and rounded up an entire alliance in NATO to stop that burgeoning genocide there. Aren't we obligated under the convention, no matter what the UN says, to act?
You're exactly right. You couldn't be more right. The problem is there's one great historical event that intrudes between Kosovo and Darfur, and it's spelled IRAQ.
So the Iraq War prevents us from acting? How so?
Well, it's extremely unlikely, as in, I would say, impossible to conceive, politically or even logistically, for the United States to mount unilaterally an intervention in Darfur. So we have to bring along allies. And we have made it so much more difficult for ourselves in bringing along allies like Great Britain or France or Germany. Germany, which, by the way, has declared that what's occurring in Darfur is genocide. So, too, by the way, has the Parliament of the European Union, which voted by a vote of 566-6 in September to declare what was happening in Darfur is genocide.
Well, then I guess I don't agree with you. As much as I oppose the Bush policy in Iraq, I don't see why Europeans can't stand up to their own words and follow what their own parliaments have said. We said it's genocide. The Germans say it's genocide. The British say it's genocide.
The British don't actually say it's genocide.
Oh, excuse me. All right, not the British. Actually, when I studied in Switzerland, I once learned the four stages of British foreign policy. They said the first stage is to say that nothing's going on. The second stage is there's something that might be going wrong. Let's appoint a commission. The third stage is let's wait for the commission's findings. And the fourth stage is it's too late to do anything. I'm afraid that I see that bad joke as an example for a lot of our diplomats around the world. But why – okay, we don't get along with our allies on Iraq, but they supported us in Afghanistan, and they understand the tremendous humanitarian concerns of what's going on in Sudan. Why can't we, notwithstanding Iraq, round up a coalition and take some action?
Well, it's a very complicated situation politically, diplomatically, militarily. We have presently in Darfur a small contingent of African Union observers. They don't have a peacekeeping mandate. They don't have a civilian protection mandate, but they are the entire international presence. They also cannot simply be ignored. Any supplement or additional force will have to work in cooperation with the African Union. Notably, this past weekend, the Secretary General of NATO made clear NATO's willingness to provide just that supplementary aid. And here we are Wednesday. I've been looking very closely, and there's been no response from the African Union, which suggests to me that the African Union may be following the lead of President Obasanjo of Nigeria, who has earlier declared that, first of all, he doesn't think it's genocide. He says he's seen genocide, and he knows that this isn't genocide. But secondly, Darfur is an Africa-only problem. Well, if Darfur is an Africa-only problem, and our only resources are those of the African Union, then this genocide cannot be stopped. We have to have the political and military and logistical cooperation of the African Union, and presently we don't have that.
Now Sudan, of course, borders, I realize Darfur is in the western region, and that's internal Africa, but it certainly borders a body of water. It borders the Red Sea, I believe. Why couldn't a United States ship make a very strong showing of reaction to at least persuade the Khartoum government that they better stop the Janjaweed militias before they themselves get overthrown?
Well, I doubt very much that Khartoum believes that a U.S. threat to overthrow the National Islamic Front regime has much credibility to it, and I don't believe it does. I, in fact, published a piece in the Washington Post this past August talking about the necessity of regime change, and I do believe true justice and peace will come to Sudan only when this tyrannical regime, which came to power by military coup in June of 1989, deposing an elected government and deliberately aborting Sudan's most promising chance for peace since independence in 1956. I believe this regime has to go, but I don't believe that the instrument of removal can be a U.S. Invasion or a U.S. military deposing. I think we need to construct a government in exile, building on the Naivasha peace process that culminated with a peace agreement between Khartoum and the southern opposition in Nairobi, Kenya, on January 9th of this year. But long term, we certainly do need to be thinking about how the National Islamic Front can be removed or so weakened as a partner in Sudan's national government that its longstanding genocidal policies, not only in southern Sudan and the Nuba Mountains, but now in Darfur, are ended as a means of domestic security policy.
Professor Reeves, we have to take a commercial break. I also want to give out the phone numbers and encourage people to call in. The phone number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. The lines are open, and we appreciate your calls. Also, I want to ask you after the break, Professor Reeves, to back off from the politics just a little bit and try to explain, and I know it's virtually an impossible task, but the one thing that they didn't answer in the movie Hotel Rwanda, which is what causes a group of people to get so animated, so excited, so angry that they actually seek out mass extermination of their neighbors. And I also want to ask you about the use of the word genocide and its misuse. So we have a lot to talk about. We'll be right back with more of the Inside Scoop right after these messages.
Was one of the biggest winners on November 2nd? Some bloke named Jerry Jones. He ran a $5 million ad blitz in Arlington, Texas to win a vote that will put $325 million of government money into his own pocket. Jerry's the billionaire owner of the Dallas Cowboys, and the vote was to get taxpayers to build a luxury sports palace for his private business. He's just one of the billionaire sports owners across America who profess to love free enterprise, but shamelessly wallow in corporate welfare. Local politicians, eager to please these moneyed power brokers, back their billionaire boondoggles, even as basic needs in their cities go begging. Take New York City, where both Mayor Michael Bloomberg and Governor George Pataki have rushed to the aid of Robert Wood Johnson IV, known as Woody to his pals and political cronies. Woody is the heir to the Johnson & Johnson fortune, a backer of various far-right-wing causes, one of the top Republican donors in the country, and owner of the New York Jets. It's in this latter capacity that Woody, a fervent free enterpriser, wants a government handout. He says his team must have a new stadium to play in, and both Bloomberg and Pataki are there for him. They're offering $600 million from New York taxpayers to build poor Woody a privileged for-profit playground on a stretch of Manhattan's most valuable land. These are the same two political leaders who keep shortchanging New York school kids, claiming there's just no money to meet their needs. 94% of the city's schools have no athletic fields, and more than half have no playgrounds for the kids. Forget playgrounds. The kids' schools are dangerously dilapidated. Parents and teachers have to chip in to buy the most basic classroom supplies, and some school bathrooms don't even have toilet paper. This is Jim Hightower saying, here's a modest proposal. Not another dime in welfare for billionaires until every school is fully stocked with toilet paper.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec, nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We're talking about the most serious human crime imaginable, the crime of genocide. It didn't just occur in Rwanda 10 years ago in the film Hotel Rwanda, which I hope you will see. It's occurring right now in Sudan, and a bunch of diplomats are dithering, including our own government. If you want to call in, the toll-free number is 877-57-SCOOP, 877-57-SCOOP. My guest is Professor Eric Reeves. His website is www.sudanreeves.org, and he's been studying the situation and the worsening situation in Sudan for many years. Caller, you're on the line with Mark Levine and Professor Eric Reeves.
This is Bill from Fairfax, and
hi,
I
Bill.
Have two questions for
yeah.
the professor. First, I noticed that the current amount of what's occurring in Darfur is Islamists versus Christians. And what I want to know is the Islamists being funded in any way by the Wahhabi teachings of the Saudi Arabians?
That's a great question.
That's the first question.
Okay, let me hold on. Let him answer that first question, because actually it's interesting to me, Professor Reeves. I wasn't sure whether this is a racial conflict, Arab versus black, religious, Muslim versus Christian, or some other. What is the animus here?
I think that's an extremely important question. Unfortunately, the question is posed by your listener is very misleading. All the people of Darfur are Muslims. There really is no significant non-Muslim population. And in fact, when we distinguish between the ethnic groups, the various non-Arab and Arab tribal groups, we're talking about people who are distinguished ethnically. They're distinguished by virtue of their agricultural practice, by virtue of language, use of Arabic, and a number of other issues. But traditionally in Darfur, been ethnic differences. These have not been racialized. What has happened in the current conflict is that ethnic differences between the African tribal groups, primarily the Fur, the Maslite, the Zagawa, and a minority of Arab tribal groups with hateful racial supremacist attitudes, racial identities have become much more salient, much more intense, much more a means of identifying oneself and one's enemies. And so the genocide that we are seeing is in many ways a contrivance on the part of Khartoum. They have exacerbated tensions that have been growing because of advancing desertification, the spread of the Sahara South, the lack of primary resources in Darfur. Water and pasturable land has led to increasing conflict, but Khartoum has long marginalized Darfur and the Darfurians, both economically and politically. There's much, much resentment also at how Khartoum has favored Arab groups, and this is really the animus that you were speaking of earlier.
Well, now, Professor Reeves, when you say Khartoum, of course, you mean the capital of Sudan, and you're referring to the current Islamicist government of Sudan. If they're all Muslims, why is it that the government is supporting one group of Arabs and against another group? I guess they're non-Arab Muslims, is that correct?
That's correct. Well, we have to look at the history of Darfur, really going back as far as 1916 when it was a sultanate, but looking just at the last 20 years or so, there was a major famine in Darfur in the mid-1980s, and this began a process that has led to increasing lawlessness, violence, growing impunity on the part of Arab militias of a smaller sort than the Janjaweed we now see, raiding African villages, looting them. And in fact, one of the precipitating events in February 2003 was a police disarming of an African village. The people whose arms had been taken stormed the police station, retrieved their weapons, and that set off a cycle of violence in that one area that has been replicated elsewhere. And we still find that the insurgency groups most often attack police stations and other parts of the Khartoum regime's vast security apparatus.
Now, Professor Reeves, what about Bill's question about whether the government is being aided by some of the Wahhabi Muslims, some of the Saudi Arabian groups that aided the Al-Qaeda as well?
Certainly there are very, very close ties between Khartoum and all the Arab capitals, not just that of Saudi Arabia, but Yemen, Syria, Iraq.
Would that include Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda as well?
Al-Qaeda, we have to remember, came to fruition in its years in Sudan. Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda had their headquarters was in Khartoum from 1991 to 1996. And from 1996 through 9/11, the Khartoum regime was very actively supporting Al-Qaeda, and bin Laden was funding him, was providing diplomatic coverage, was cooperating in efforts to attack, for example, the U.S. Embassy in New Delhi. We're talking about a regime that's largely unchanged since it came to power in 1989, which has a long history of supporting terrorism and bin Laden. And these men are the same men.
And far greater than, say, of Saddam Hussein.
There's no question. We can't really compare in any way the relationship between and strong support and ideological support, fervent ideological support of Khartoum for Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda, and what we have discovered really only very tenuous relationship between Saddam Hussein and international terrorism, certainly.
Let me get back to Bill. I know he had a second question. Bill, what was your second question?
The professor mentioned that we need to establish a government in exile. My worry is, if we establish a government in exile, will this government that comes in, do we have a history of these governments coming in, then wiping out the people who wiped out their predecessors? In other words, will the new group just become a new group to go ahead and commit genocide?
I get your point, Bill. Thank you very much for your call. Professor Reeves, is there a fear that there'll be a counter-genocidal reaction?
No. I think any government in exile would necessarily have to be proportional. And in some ways, we're seeing this happen de facto. The northern opposition groups, which are mainly in exile, fall under an umbrella called the NDA, the National Democratic Alliance. These represent groups other than the small elite Arab groups that have ruled Sudan since independence in 1956. But we also need to be talking about the people of Darfur, who've long, as I said earlier, been politically marginalized. We need to talk about the Bija people in eastern Sudan. We need to talk about the various peoples of the south who have seen a peace agreement reached again this year, January 9th. But that peace is very, very fragile. It needs much greater consensus. I think we need to include the people of the Nuba Mountains, southern Blue Nile. Sudan, we must remember, is geographically huge and almost incomprehensibly diverse. It's as large as the Mississippi east, as large as the United States east of the Mississippi.
Wow.
There are hundreds of languages and things. Any government that is a government of that nation, of that size and diversity, is going to have to be fundamentally different.
A coalition government
now exists.
In other words, a coalition government of the many peoples that are there.
Otherwise, we are going to have insurgencies, violence, rebellions, reactions to chronic marginalization, the sort that have defined all of Sudan's modern history.
Professor Rees, I know you have to go soon. I do want to raise one last issue, and it's an issue I raised before you came on air, and that has to do with the word genocide. And my contention, at least, that the word has been overused so much to describe situations that, while bad or evil, do not rise to the level of genocide, that I think that the overuse actually harms the cause of preventing genocide. I wonder if you could comment on that.
Well, I couldn't agree more. Nothing could serve the cause of genocide prevention more poorly than the promiscuous use of the word. On the other hand, when we establish that genocide is clearly happening, as it clearly is in Darfur, and if we say it's happening and we don't act, we've got a situation in many ways worse than that in Rwanda, where the Clinton administration and others refused to use the word, fearing that there would be consequences if they did. Now, unfortunately, we have, as I say, something even worse. We use the word, but we don't respond to the reality. That's the shocking thing about the Bush administration finding of genocide and doing as little as it has by way of bringing international pressure to bear. But the United States is not alone in its culpability here. Europe, European nations, the European Union, NATO, Canada, Japan, the Arab League, the African Union, there is a great deal of international culpability here.
And is it just because people don't want to get involved because it might cost some troops and lives and money? Is it just that? Or is it something deeper than that? I mean, in Hotel Rwanda, we actually saw, and I don't know if it's fair to say, but we saw a white UN official talking to the actor Don Cheadle and saying, well, you're black, so we're not going to get involved. Is there racism going on here?
There certainly is. I won't say that's the exclusive factor, but you can't get much lower on the geopolitical totem pole than being black, poor, Muslim, remote, and geopolitically inconsequential. And that defines Darfur. That's why there's no response. I won't presume to sort out which of these is the predominant factor, but certainly that these people are black Africans makes it much more difficult for the international community to respond, and that is a form of racism, certainly.
And yet I think Americans, when I see, for example, the way that George Bush has talked about, you know, the Iraqi elections and we're freeing Iraqis, people who, while certainly suffering under Saddam Hussein, have undergone nowhere near the privations and torture and executions of the people of Sudan going on right now, it seems to me the American people definitely have it in their hearts to welcome, and indeed, for all the talk about Iraq, when you look at the needs of the Sudanese, again, it's much greater. Last question is, what can you and I and our listeners do to persuade ordinary Americans, to persuade politicians, to get people moving on this issue?
I think there are two possibilities. One longer term, and that is to begin a divestment campaign modeled on the one that ended apartheid in South Africa. It needs to be more urgent. The targets need to be those Asian and European countries that continue to allow their corporations to support the Khartoum regime. I urge your listeners to go to www.divestsudan.org. The other thing your listeners can do is write to Congress and demand that the State Department release its list of genocidaires, those people who are guilty in the Khartoum regime of genocide. The State Department has compiled this list and refuses to make it public, even though that is demanded by the Comprehensive Sudan Peace Act of October 2004. The State Department needs to hear from members of Congress that this is intolerable, that we know who the genocidaires are. We know who those people commissioning genocide are, and yet we won't say it out loud for expedient diplomatic reasons.
Professor Rees, I thank you so much for your passion, for your work, and of course, for coming here on The Inside Scoop. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Well, we're going to go to commercial break. When we come back, I want to talk a little bit about genocide afterwards, the apology that Bill Clinton made, the memory. I also want to talk about the role of the Catholic Church in the Holocaust. There's been quite a lot of discussion on the blog about this, and a reminder that those who don't remember the past are condemned to repeat it. We'll be right back right after this.
Hey, by the way, how was the doctor the other day?
Good, but my cholesterol's 200. It's a little high.
Yeah, I'm around 760.
760? You're kidding me.
Pretty impressive, huh?
No, not impressive. Not impressive at all. What are you on, some sort of butter diet?
Yeah, you know, I figured at 760, getting a loan on the new car should be no problem.
Loan? What are you talking about, man? You're not going to live long enough to pay back a loan.
There's physical help, and then there's financial help. With Score Power from Equifax, you'll get your credit report, credit score, and you'll learn how your credit decisions can affect your score, all for just $14.95. It's the first step toward healthy credit, and a score of 760 is pretty healthy. So check out Score Power at Equifax.com or call 1-877-4-EQUIFAX. That's EQUIFAX. Equifax.
Yeah, I figure I can get up to around 790 by the end of the year, you know, if I'm lucky.
Look, a little advice.
Yeah?
Eat a vegetable, a smoothie, something, man.
Get the power. Score Power at Equifax.com.
Your dog eats your new sofa. Pet satisfaction rating 3%. Your hairdresser doesn't know burnt auburn from burnt toast. Hair color satisfaction rating 5%. After years of marriage, your husband still leaves the seat up. Spouse satisfaction rating minus 2%. Your car insurance company saves you hundreds of dollars and handles your claim quickly and fairly. Car insurance satisfaction rating 97%. Oh, you must have Geico.
Geico's customer satisfaction stands at 97%. How would you rate your car insurance company? Geico. 1-800-947-AUTO.
It's night. You have heartburn. You want fast relief. Zantac works fast. When first used, Prilosec OTC works not so fast. Zantac works right when you need it.
Hello, relief.
Prilosec's label says it may take 1 to 4 days to fully work. So, what would you choose?
Estimated time of relief, 1 to 4 days.
Prilosec, nah. Zantac's for people who hate to wait, especially at night. Use as directed.
Welcome back to the Inside Scoop. I'm your host, Mark Levine. We've been talking about genocide. It's a horrible topic to discuss, and yet one so necessary. If all of us are just to be a moral human beings, we've talked about what went on currently in Sudan. I want to talk a little, though, about historical memory. It seems to me that if you do not recall and face bluntly what happened in the past, you are condemned to repeat it. As much as I condemn Bill Clinton for failing to act in Rwanda in 1994, I praise the man for coming back, recognizing he did wrong and apologizing. I also praise Bill Clinton for stopping the genocide in Kosovo. We haven't seen George Bush Sr. even mention the genocide in Bosnia. And of course, George Bush Jr. has done nothing of any importance in Sudan. In fact, he's done, as our guest Professor Reeves argued, the worst of both worlds. He has labeled what's going on a genocide and then done nothing about it. There's been a lot of controversy recently about Pope Pius XII. The Catholic Pope was Pope during the war, during the Holocaust, during World War II, and how little he did to act. In fact, some news documents have come out showing that even after the war, Pope Pius XII authorized the kidnapping of Jewish children. Basically, Jewish children were hidden away in order to save their lives, and if people managed to baptize those children, Pope Pius XII said they should not be returned to their Jewish parents, the survivors of the Holocaust. And in fact, the Vatican lied to many people after the war, to these survivors, these Holocaust survivors, in a way to basically keep their children away from them. There's been a lot of controversy over this, and yet the facts are pretty overwhelming. And that's why I've mentioned them. Really, I was surprised to find that anyone challenged them, particularly since the Vatican will not release documents on it. But let's go through just a few of the facts, just so everyone is clear that Pope Pius XII certainly did not do all he could. In fact, probably the best way to describe Pope Pius XII is in the same manner one might describe Pétain of France or Quisling of Norway as being a Nazi collaborator. Even before he became Pope, his name was Cardinal Pacelli, and he engineered, well, I wouldn't say engineered, that's too strong. Let's just say he helped the Nazis rise to power. If you study German history, you know that the middle party, the party that joined with the Nazis to put Hitler in power, was the Catholic Party, the Zentrum. And Pacelli wrote a letter to the Zentrum, read out by the party leader, in fact, Monsignor Ludwig Kass, at a central meeting in May 1932, saying that the Pope was worried about the rise of communism and therefore advised that the Catholic Party support Hitler. Hitler was, I guess, the lesser of two evils. On March 28th, the Fulda Bishops' Conference had backed the Nazis, and in April, Rome refused to issue a condemnation of anti-Semitism. It went on after Hitler came to power. One of the very first agreements signed by the Nazi government was with the Vatican. And this was done after Hitler had assumed dictatorial powers, after mass arrests, book burnings, the first concentration camp Dachau. Indeed, Hitler had banned all political parties except the Nazi party, and yet the Pope continued to sign a concordat, an agreement, a treaty with Hitler that Hitler praised on July 14th, saying, quote, "An opportunity has been given to Germany in the Reichskonkordat, and a sphere of influence has been created that will be especially significant in the urgent struggle against international Jewry." Basically, in this agreement, the Pope got to control some schools in Germany and in return gave up the separate German Catholic Party and, again, as I said, refused to condemn anti-Semitism. Basically, Pius XII made a few moral complaints to the Pope. They were few, they were tepid, they were far between, they were not public. The heart of what Pope Pius XII refused to do, though, and there's a lot of history on this, is he refused to excommunicate the many, many Catholics that were participating in the Holocaust. Probably more than one quarter of all the mass murderers were Catholic. Don't get me wrong, 95% of them were Christian, so I don't mean to in any way say that Catholics were there alone here. But the Pope had a moral obligation, it seems to me. He could tell Catholics what to do. Remember, this is a Vatican that had excommunicated Galileo for saying the earth went around the sun. And yet Adolf Hitler, who was baptized a Catholic, would not be excommunicated. Indeed, Pope Pius XII refused to excommunicate any Nazis, any Nazi camp guards. And some Catholic apologists argue, well, you know, he was afraid for his life and he really was afraid to act. And frankly, it wouldn't have done anything at all. Well, we know that's not true, because we do see there are patterns of righteous people, mostly Christian, I should say, who stood up against the Nazis and saw their actions take place. Probably the most famous example is during the Holocaust when Hitler started executing the mentally retarded, the handicapped. Well, churches rose up, Protestant and Catholic as one in Germany, and said, don't kill my brother, my cousin, just because he's mentally retarded or because he's lost a limb. And the pressure was so great that Hitler backed down and stopped the killing. There was a little bit of killing that went on in private, but the mass killings were gone. When Jews were deported from various neighborhoods and to concentration camps, the Danish population stood up. The King of Denmark stood up and saved virtually the entire population of Denmark. The Dutch stood up. Who didn't stand up? The Pope. Indeed, it's well known the Nazis' main fear was that the Pope would stand up and excommunicate the Nazis. Why didn't Pius XII tell his bishops, don't participate in genocide? Unfortunately, many of them did, particularly in Slovakia and in other countries. So Pope Pius XII was, in essence, helping Hitler. Now, is it because he loved Hitler? No, probably because he hated communists, because he hated Jews, as so many of his generation did. Remember, this is before Vatican II. The church had a long teaching that Jews had killed Jesus and were guilty of deicide, literally killing God. And, you know, it was understandable that he of his generation didn't act. But please, let's not hide the facts. Let's not pretend that he didn't do some pretty heinous acts. The reason I bring this up now is not only because there's been some discussion on the blog, but because if we do not remember the acts, we are condemned to repeat them. That's why Hotel Rwanda is so important. That's why shows like this are so important. And I want to read from you the kind of apology I would love to see from the Vatican. It comes from a group of French Catholics who understand the role their church played in the Holocaust. This is a direct quote from the Declaration of Repentance that the French bishops gave in 1997. Quote, "It is a well-proven fact that for centuries, up until Vatican Council II, an anti-Jewish tradition stamped its mark in differing ways on Christian doctrine and teaching, in theology, apologetics, preaching, and the liturgy. It was on such ground that the venomous plant of hatred for the Jews was able to flourish. Hence the heavy inheritance the Church still bears in our century, with all its consequences which are so difficult to wipe out. Hence are still open wounds. They go on to say that basically it is the Church's long teaching of anti-Semitism that provided the fertile grounds for Nazism. And they conclude by saying, for this failing of the Church of France and of her responsibility toward the Jewish people are part of our history. We confess this sin, we beg God's pardon, and we call upon the Jewish people to hear our words of repentance. That, my friends, is exactly what's necessary, whether it be in Rwanda between Hutus and Tutsis, in the South African Reconciliation Commission, or when we can ever get past Sudan. The parties need the murderers and those that helped the murderers and those that just stayed silent and collaborated with them need to come clean about what they've done if we're ever to move on. I want to praise the French bishops for doing that. And John Paul II, I know he's sick. He really needs to stop the process of trying to make Pope Pius XII into some kind of saint. Pope Pius XII did some beastly, horrible acts. No, he didn't actually gas any prisoners, but he certainly made it more people die by collaborating with the Nazis. And it's not anti-Christian to say so. I'm amazed by the people on the blog that say it's anti-Christian to simply tell the truth, and that is that Pope Pius XII helped Hitler in his goals. It's a simple fact. I've had one blog member even challenge me to a public debate, and I say anytime, anywhere on this issue. Clearly, Pope Pius XII was not the only moral failure. Those include Franklin Delano Roosevelt for failing to bomb the Auschwitz camps, Churchill, Winston Churchill, for failing to open Palestine to Jewish refugees, and certainly Christians and non-Christians across Europe who participated in the death camps, who were Hitler's willing executioners. There's a lot of blame to go on, but the main thing is that people not hide from the truth. People need to face it fairly, and the best way to do it in this case is for the Vatican to open up its records and discuss everything it did, from helping Hitler before the war, to not speaking out during the war, to helping Nazi war criminals escape prosecution by going to Latin America after the war and helping kidnap Jewish children. All of the information needs to come out, just with Rwanda, just with every other place. And when it does, that's when healing can begin. Until then, I'm afraid it's an open sore, and I'm afraid that genocide will continue. That's it for the Inside Scoop today. Tomorrow, we've got a very important show going back to